From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I had a new clearance in my pocket, which said I could enter Gitmo. It had been faxed the night before, but when I tried to check in for the private plane at Kingston, Jamaica, they said the Pentagon had just called and I was barred, and they gave no reason.
The United States bars journalists from the military prison at Guantanamo Bay just days after three prisoners commit suicide there. We'll speak with a reporter prevented from entering Guantanamo and another who was forced off the island. Then award-winning New York Times columnist Paul Krugman on the new class war in America.
A lot of things have become more visible since George Bush was installed in the White House, but it didn't start there. There's this great sweep of history trying to understand what happened. And a lot of it has to do with questions of inequality of class.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A newly released Pentagon study reveals U.S. forces held Iraqi detainees for up to 7 days at a time in cells so tiny they could neither stand nor lie down. The cells measured 4 feet high, 4 feet long, and 20 inches wide. One Iraqi detainee alleged his captors duct-taped his mouth and nose before placing him in the box-like cell. The Pentagon investigation also determined some Iraqi detainees were fed only bread and water for up to 17 days, during which time they were chained to the floor of their cells. Other Iraqis were stripped naked, deprived of sleep, and assailed with loud music. The Pentagon report was completed in November 2004, but only made public last week in response to a Freedom of Information request from the American Civil Liberties Union. The report's author, Army Brigadier General Richard Formica, determined the troops used unauthorized interrogation methods that violated the Geneva Conventions, but he recommended no U.S. troops be disciplined for abusing Iraqis. In other news from Iraq, the U.S. military is searching for two soldiers who've been missing since Saturday. Iraq's foreign minister told CNN the soldiers were seized by a group of insurgents. The soldiers were identified as Christian Menchaca of Houston, Texas, and Thomas Tucker of Madras, Oregon. They are the first U.S. soldiers to have been reported missing in action in Iraq in 2 years. In Baghdad, 43 people died Saturday in a series of 7 bombings. On Friday, 11 people were killed when a suicide bomber exploded a shoe bomb inside a Shiite mosque in Baghdad. Meanwhile, thousands of U.S. and Iraqi troops have completely surrounded the Sunni city of Ramadi. New checkpoints were established on Saturday. The United Nations is reporting nearly 10,000 residents of Ramadi have already fled the city, fearing a Fallujah-like assault. In Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives has voted to reject setting a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. The vote was 256 to 153. The Republican leadership accused dissenting Democrats of failing to support the troops. But Congressmember John Murtha, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, slammed the Republican tactics.
The only way we can change things in Iraq is to change direction. It has to be changed on the ground. What we say here today, as President Lincoln said in the Gettysburg Address, is going to mean very little. It'll get lost in a rhetoric. What means something is what happens on the ground. All of us support the troops. If you vote for the appropriation bill, the defense appropriation bill, you voted to support the troops. If you vote for the armed services bill, you voted to support the troops. I believe this resolution, if you vote for it, you're voting to support a failed policy wrapped in illusion, and I would recommend to the members they vote against this resolution.
Pennsylvania Democrat John Murtha. An internal memo from the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad leaked to the Washington Post reveals the situation in the Iraqi capital is far more dire than portrayed by the Bush administration. The memo mentions that one Arab newspaper editor is preparing an extensive study on how ethnic cleansing is now occurring in almost every Iraqi province. One Iraqi employee of the embassy said he attends a funeral every evening. Neighborhoods in Baghdad are now mostly controlled by militias. Islamic groups are enforcing strict social codes. Women are increasingly pressured to cover their faces. It's also now considered dangerous for men and children to wear shorts outside. Iraqis working in the U.S. Embassy must now keep their place of work a secret, even from their own families, because anti-American sentiment is so high. For the past 6 months, the embassy has been unable to call Iraqi workers at home or use them as translators for on-camera press events for their own safety. The memo from the U.S. Embassy was sent to Washington last week ahead of President Bush's visit to Baghdad. In Afghanistan, the U.S. military has launched its largest offensive since the fall of the Taliban in late 2001. More than 10,000 troops are spreading out over four southern provinces to fight the Taliban. Over the past month, more than 500 people have died in Afghanistan in some of the heaviest fighting of the war. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting the U.S. military has carried out 340 airstrikes in Afghanistan over the past 3 months. That's more than double the number of airstrikes conducted in Iraq during the same period. The New York Times is reporting North Korea may have completed fueling a long-range ballistic missile. Unnamed American officials told the paper this greatly increases the possibility that North Korea will conduct its first test launching in 8 years. Japan's warning it'll take severe action if North Korea launches a long-range missile. Here in New Orleans, public housing advocates are protesting the federal government's decision to eliminate 5,000 units of public housing. NAACP civil rights attorney Tracy Washington has announced plans to sue the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And activists with the group United Front for Affordable Housing have vowed to use any means necessary to stop the bulldozing of their apartments. If the federal government's plan goes forward, New Orleans will have lost 85% of its public housing over the past decade. The development has been welcomed by some. Shortly after Katrina devastated the city, Republican Congressmember Richard Baker from Baton Rouge reportedly said, quote, "We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did," he said. In religious news, Catherine Jefferts Schori of Nevada has been elected to head the Episcopal Church, becoming the first woman to ever lead a church in the World Anglican Communion. Her election comes at a time when many Anglican churches still don't acknowledge that women can become priests. Bishop Schori is a former oceanographer who became a priest a decade ago. In news from Capitol Hill, the House has voted to remove Congressmember William Jefferson of Louisiana from the Ways and Means Committee. Jefferson's under federal investigation for bribery, but he has not yet been charged with a crime. The Congressional Black Caucus opposed the move. It's believed that the House has never taken such a harsh step against a member not charged with a crime. Last month, the FBI raided Jefferson's congressional office, touching off a constitutional debate over the powers of the executive body to seize evidence from lawmakers. The state of New Jersey has subpoenaed records from five major telephone companies in an effort to determine whether they broke the state's consumer protection laws by providing records to the National Security Agency. The companies subpoenaed are AT&T, Verizon, Qwest, Sprint, Nextel, and Singular Wireless. Now the Bush administration is attempting to block New Jersey's investigation. Last week, the Justice Department filed a lawsuit to halt the subpoenas. In news from Britain, the Observer newspaper reports the British government has been secretly awarding honors to senior U.S. military and business leaders connected to the Iraq invasion. The list includes Riley Bechtel, the head of the U.S. company Bechtel, General Tommy Franks, and Vice Admiral Timothy Keating. In New York, over 200 people demonstrated at Ground Zero Saturday to protest the government's failure to respond to the health effects of 9/11. Among the protesters was Joseph Zagroda. His son, New York Police Detective James Zagroda, died at the age of 34 in January from heart and lung complications directly related to the 9/11 attacks. In labor news, janitors and groundskeepers at the University of Miami in Florida have voted to unionize and join the Service Employees International Union. Earlier this year, the janitors staged a 9-week strike against Unico, the Boston-based company contracted to provide janitors for the private university. And in Bangkok, dozens of Burmese exiles, Thai activists, and Buddhist monks gathered earlier today to mark the 61st birthday of the imprisoned Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The 1991 Nobel Peace Prize winner has spent 10 of the past 16 years in prison. This is San San, an exiled member of the National League for Democracy.
She is our hope and she is our victory. And I want international community to press our military regime to release her unconditionally and immediately.
Sun Sun of the National League for Democracy. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. has barred journalists from the military prison at Guantanamo Bay. Three visiting reporters were forced off the island Wednesday under orders from the Office of the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. A Pentagon spokesperson said the removals were ordered following complaints from other media outlets they were being denied equal access. But questions are being raised over whether the Pentagon was motivated by a different reason. Last week's Guantanamo suicides have only intensified international scrutiny of the U.S.-run prison. The three banned reporters from the Los Angeles Times, the Miami Herald, and the Charlotte Observer were the only journalists who were able to file reports on the suicides from Guantanamo. Our first guest is one of those three reporters. Carol Williams is the Caribbean bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. She wrote a piece in Sunday's LA Times entitled Kicked Out of Gitmo. She speaks to us from St. Kitts. We're also joined by David Rose, journalist who writes for the Observer of London and Vanity Fair. He's the author of several books, including Guantanamo, America's War on Human Rights, which has just come out in paperback. Last week, he was on his way to Guantanamo to cover a military tribunal when he suddenly had his clearance revoked. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let us begin with Carol Williams. Carol, can you talk about what happened on Guantanamo? How long were you there? When were you told you had to leave? When were you flown out?
I was there for 5 days, and I was told, actually before I even left Fort Lauderdale on a charter flight to Guantanamo on the Saturday of the suicides, that I shouldn't go because my travel clearance had been revoked by the Office of the Military Commissions, which runs the tribunals, and we were going down to cover a session of the tribunals. But because I had been to Guantanamo previously under authorization of different arms of the Pentagon, I called the admiral in charge of the detention facility and asked his staff if I couldn't come down anyway, because even though there were no tribunals to cover that week, that there was a story that, you know, American readers needed to know about. And after some back and forth, he agreed, and he invited myself and Carol Rosenberg from the Miami Herald to proceed with our trip.
And so you went there, and how long were you there?
There were 5 days. On the Monday, 2 days after we arrived, I got a call from the same person from Rumsfeld's office who had said our travel clearance to cover the tribunals had been revoked, to say we had to leave because it wasn't fair to the other journalists that the Pentagon was preventing from coming down for us to be there to cover the story. So this went back and forth again for another couple of days. And then on Tuesday night, we were told that we had, that by the Admiral staff, that they had been given orders from the Secretary of Defense office to clear the island of media by the following morning. And they put us on a military plane, bound for Miami, and shipped us off.
So you were there at the time of the suicides?
No, we were there a few hours later. They occurred overnight, actually, I think shortly after midnight, early Saturday morning. And we were coincidentally flying into Guantanamo from Fort Lauderdale. Myself and Carol Rosenberg live in Miami and cover our beats from there. So we were flying separately from the rest of the Office of Military Commissions delegation that was supposed to leave, I believe, on Sunday on a military flight from Andrews Air Force Base. And because the British journalists who were coming to cover the tribunals and some of our other colleagues had been booked through the military to get down to Guantanamo, when they canceled the tribunals, they canceled the flight to bring the journalists and staff down. So they were kind of marooned. But, you know, we argued with the Defense Department that our colleagues should be allowed to proceed, when they were making the argument that, you know, it wasn't right for us to be there because our, you know, competitors and fellow journalists weren't there. You know, we proposed a number of junctures that they let those people come down. You know, the whole media should be there. And we would have been happy to pool the information if that was the only way, you know, we could stay and, you know, to get around this perception that it was somehow unfair that any eyes of the world were on Guantanamo that week.
It's interesting to note the link between the two of you, the two of our guests. David Rose, you write, three U.S. reporters at the base were ordered to leave. According to a Pentagon spokesman quoted by the U.S. media, the reason was that two barred British reporters, us, had threatened to sue if the Americans were allowed to stay. This was, of course, untrue, you write. So in other words, you say the Pentagon is falsely blaming you for the reason why Carol Williams was forced to leave Guantanamo?
Absolutely. The full story of my experiences is quite Kafkaesque. It's an overused epithet, but I think it's applicable in this instance. I was in the air when news of the suicides broke on my way from London. I arrived in Washington on Saturday evening and discovered that the flight from Andrews to Gitmo had been cancelled, as had the military commission. So the first thing I did next morning was call the Pentagon, the Office of Military Commissions, and I spoke to Jeffrey D. Gordon, a naval lieutenant commander who is in charge of granting media access to the military commissions. I said, look, I've come a long way. With the suicides, there's clearly a very good reason for going to Guantanamo. And I'd already made arrangements with the Guantanamo public affairs people that, as well as covering the military commissions, I would tour the base, as I have done before, and interview other officials about the general regime at Guantanamo. So at this point, he couldn't have been more helpful. He said, look, I can't give you a new clearance because you had clearance for the military commission. Although, as he accepted, I did also have clearance for a more general tour of the base. So he said, talk to the folks at Gitmo, talk to the people at Southcom, and you can probably get a new clearance. So within an hour or so, I was talking to Naval Lieutenant Commander Robert Durand, who's in charge of the Gitmo Public Affairs Office, and he said, look, I'm sure it'll be fine. I'll talk to the Admiral. He's a very open sort of guy. You can get new clearance. And indeed, I have an email from him, which was copied to me, where he explains to one of his colleagues that I'm going to get new clearance. He's going to talk to the Admiral, and he asks his colleague to assist me with getting transportation. Well, as it turned out, it was very difficult to get a flight. The small little scheduled flights that fly out of Fort Lauderdale and Kingston, Jamaica were full. But with another British colleague, David Jones, the Daily Mail, we managed to find a firm that was willing to fly us on a personal charter from Kingston, Jamaica. Anyhow, things went on during the afternoon, and finally, at 7 o'clock in the evening or so, I got a call from Guantanamo saying, great news, your clearances have come through, we'll fax them to your hotel. So by 1953 that evening, that's the time on the fax, I had a new clearance to enter Guantanamo Bay to report on the aftermath of the suicides and to interview officials there. On the strength of that, I got up early the next morning with David Jones. We went from Dulles Airport down to Miami. We checked in once more with Guantanamo. We spoke to officials there. They said, you're good to go. We'll meet your plane when you arrive at 6:30 p.m. has arrived. We'll have a full program for you. You can stay the rest of the week. So we thought, fine, this is just great. So we ponied up the $4,000 for the private plane and flew on to Kingston, Jamaica. Well, we were just checking in for the private flight at Kingston that afternoon when the manager, looking very flustered, came and said, look, I'm really sorry, guys, you can't go. I said, what do you mean? We have clearances. He said, well, they've just been revoked. I said, what do you mean they've been revoked? We got them last night. Look, here's the facts, 1953. He said, I've just had a call from Jeffrey D. Gordon, the same official in the Pentagon, in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Your clearances have been revoked. You can't travel. Well, I called J.D. Gordon, and here's the really interesting part. I said, why can't we go? He said, because the two Carols from the Miami Herald and the LA Times have just been ordered to leave. I can't let you come when they've been ordered to leave, or the whole of the American media will be down on my neck like a ton of bricks. I can't order Americans out and let British reporters in. I said, you're telling me they've already been ordered to leave and we can't come? He said, that's the position. Well, this is very interesting what Carol has just said, because it's clear that she wasn't even told to leave until the following evening. So while they're using, when speaking to us, the OSD, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, is using the American reasons, American reporters, as a reason for not letting us in. When expelling the Americans, they're using us, the Brits, as a reason for them having to leave. In fact, both these statements are untrue. They hadn't told the Americans to leave. There was no reason at all not to let us go and use the clearance that we'd obtained. Equally, we were not threatening to sue or making any other kind of complaint. We were just very angry that we'd been told we had clearance to go, and suddenly it had been revoked. provoked and no reason was being given. What made it even worse was that, you know, we had further phone and email contact over the next few days, which ended up by Jeffrey D. Gordon claiming, absolutely falsely, that I had obtained a clearance from a junior enlisted clerk, whereas in fact, as the email I have from the head of Gitmo Public Affairs shows very clearly, it had come from the base admiral. And then when I pointed this out to him, he accused me of dubious professional conduct at best, which is really quite extraordinary.
We're talking to David Rose, British journalist who writes for The Observer of London and Vanity Fair. He's speaking to us from Oxford in England. And Carol Williams is aligned with us from St. Kitts. She's the Caribbean bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. We'll come back to both of them in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on more than 450 radio and television stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR radio stations, on low-power FM and college and community radio stations, and on public access TV and PBS stations, as well as on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our transcripts are also there. We're talking about reporters being banned from or not allowed into Guantanamo, kicked off of the prison camp last week. Carol Williams is with us, Caribbean bureau chief for the LA Times. She was flown out last week. She's now in St. Kitts. David Rose is a British journalist, writes for The Observer of London, Vanity Fair, and has written the book Guantanamo, The War on Human Rights. He was expecting to come into Guantanamo, but was barred from entering. David Rose, today the British Parliament is holding a hearing on British complicity in the rendition of Bimyam Mohammed, the British resident who was arrested in Pakistan. Can you talk about this case, why you were going to Guantanamo?
Yes, absolutely. Bimyam Mohammed's case is one of the most shocking and the most copiously documented cases we have of extraordinary rendition. He was arrested in Pakistan in, April of 2002. And he was taken to Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan and then a place which is known as the Dark Prison, a CIA facility in Afghanistan. By the time he left that place, after what he says was extremely abusive and coercive treatment, he had made a confession which was so extraordinary, it barely bears consideration. He apparently, as a new Muslim convert who had in fact gone to Pakistan because he had a drug problem, is supposed to have had, in a public restaurant in Pakistan in the early part of 2002, months after 9/11, a dinner party with the entire al-Qaeda leadership, including, for example, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, then the world's most wanted man, the architect of 9/11, Ramzi bin al-Shib, the former flatmate of Mohammed Atta, and Jose Padilla, the American citizen, who, of course, was shortly to be arrested himself. Now, the allegation is that at this dinner party, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed cooked up a plan whereby Bimyam Mohammed would fly to Central Asia, somehow obtain some uranium, smuggle it into the United States, not an easy thing to do, you might think, and then he and Padilla would build a dirty bomb together and set it off somewhere in New York. Well, having made this confession, he was then shipped to Morocco by the CIA, where he was held for about a year in a place which is clearly a center for torture, where really unspeakable things were done to him. The worst thing that was done is that on a number of occasions he was cut on his body and also on his genitals with a scalpel. He was also severely beaten. He endured sexual assaults. And I should say that I've interviewed two other prisoners in recent weeks who were also in the same place, who described these things happening, not to themselves, but witnessing it happening to other prisoners. Having spent a year in Morocco, he was finally taken to Guantanamo Bay, and he faces trial by military commission for this plan to let off a dirty bomb with Jose Padilla, who he says he has never met. And it was for his military commission hearing, the preliminary hearing, motions hearing in that case, that I was planning to go to Guantanamo. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that Padilla himself was facing charges as a so-called enemy combatant, despite the fact he was a US citizen, and he was being held in a military prison, I think it was in North Carolina. And then eventually the authorities realized they just couldn't make this stick. He's now back in federal custody, and he's facing much less serious charges. But the crucial thing is, why did they send Binyam Mohamed to Morocco when he had already made this confession? Now, we don't have proof of this, but certainly we speculate that the reason was that in Morocco, they hoped they would so crush his resistance that he would in fact become the prosecutor's witness, the prosecution witness against Padilla. They could then try Padilla on the dirty bomb charge, and he would be... He would perhaps have some lesser punishment as a witness. Now, he wouldn't do that, and that's why he is now facing this dirty bomb charge in Guantanamo, where, of course, the rules of evidence and due process are far laxer than they are in any federal court, although the case against Padilla has been dropped. Now, almost as we speak, a hearing is about to take place in the House of Commons in London, in which evidence will be called that suggests that the British Intelligence and Security Service, MI5, played a substantial part in his treatment in Morocco, in that the interrogators in Morocco who were torturing him so vilely were feeding him questions that can only have been obtained by the security service in London.
And this is the tribunal you thought you were going down to cover, and this is what the British Parliament's dealing with today?
It's not actually the Parliament. It's an MP in the Parliament who's convened a kind of special hearing to call evidence on this. It's taking part in the taking place in the precincts of the Parliament, but it's not the Parliament itself.
It's not just journalists who've been barred from Guantanamo. Lawyers have been too, and apparently witnesses. Attorneys representing detainees were prevented from meeting with their clients at Guantanamo. And on Sunday, the Boston Globe revealed the U.S. government failed to provide Guantanamo detainees access to key witnesses for their tribunals, even though some of those witnesses were readily available. In nearly every single case, out of a total of 64 witnesses, 34 detainees were told their witnesses couldn't be located. But in the case of one detainee alone, the Boston Globe was able to locate three witnesses in a span of just 3 days. In another case, the State Department said it could not locate Afghanistan's Minister of Energy, even though the minister meets frequently with U.S. diplomats. Your response?
Well, these military commissions are a mockery of any kind of normal court process. They've changed the rules repeatedly since they first announced they were setting them up. But they're essentially there, I think, to provide a kind of spurious justification for the whole Guantanamo experiment, for this wholesale erosion both of the principles of the U.S. Constitution, the law of war, and international law in general. They have to get somebody convicted in these commissions, or else the whole experiment is going to look like such a catastrophic disaster. If every single one of those detainees eventually ends up going home, as I strongly suspect they will, without anybody having been convicted for any kind of crime, the political damage and embarrassment, not only within the US and the implications for the administration which is responsible for this, but the damage to the United States' image abroad is almost incalculable. A senior Pentagon intelligence official told me a long time ago when I was preparing my book that he imagined that for every Guantanamo detainee, you would create at least 10 terrorists. I think possibly that figure should be multiplied by another 10 or even 100. The way these things are going, you know, there could not be a better recruiting sergeant for international terrorism than Guantanamo Bay.
We're also joined by Carol Williams. And Carol, the beginning of your piece, Kicked Out of Gitmo, a Times reporter struggle to get the truth about America's island prison, just got tougher. You write, in the best of times, covering Guantanamo means wrangling with a Kafkaesque bureaucracy, with logistics so nonsensical that they turn 2 hours of reporting into an 18-hour day with hostile escorts who seem to think you're in league with Al-Qaeda. Do you think you were thrown off the island because of the suicides and the kind of coverage that you and your colleagues were doing there?
I think it's all mounted to create the situation where the Pentagon just doesn't want any coverage of Guantanamo. What David was saying about the, you know, specific case of Binyam Mohammed, he was in the tribunal in April, and it became apparent that the case against him, you know, is weak at best. He was able to, you know, make a mockery of the proceedings. The presiding officer ended up having to suspend the session because of the challenges that were brought by his attorneys. The few windows we've had into the judicial process have been a public relations disaster for the Pentagon, and I think their move to bar all coverage is a consequence of that. You know, they're finding it impossible to manage the message in the way that they had expected to.
Carol Williams, can you talk about what it is like? You've been to Guantanamo how many times now?
Six, I think.
And how you gather information. For example, how you found out about a mass hanging.
As I said in the Sunday opinion piece, much of what we get is by accident or from people who don't know that they're supposed to be spinning this story as opposed to telling it or answering questions directly. The mass suicide that I was told about inadvertently occurred in late 2003, and I found that out because I was being taken on a tour of the detention facilities. I was in the prison annex of the U.S. Naval Hospital, and the Naval Hospital commander, who was showing me, you know, the 48-bed facility and all the, you know, state-of-the-art equipment, was, you know, giving me statistics. And I asked him, just, you know, apropos of nothing, what have you ever been at or near capacity? And he said innocently, just after the mass hanging incident. And nobody from the U.S. media or any media had ever heard about any mass hanging incident. The Pentagon was, you know, asked to provide details about this, and 2.5 weeks later, at 10 o'clock on a Friday night, they emailed the three of us who had been at Guantanamo when this disclosure was made to say that, yeah, 23 of the detainees had hung themselves together with torn-up bed sheets during a particular week in what was clearly a coordinated effort to make a statement. Even back then, this was almost 3 years ago, that, you know, they were despairing of their conditions and clearly wanted to make a statement.
Carol Williams, there's a piece in the London Times, Guantanamo Deaths, Not Suicide, Say Families. I wanted to ask you about it. It's by Simon Friedman. It says, fresh postmortems were being prepared today on the repatriated bodies of three Guantanamo detainees found dead in their cells last week, and claims from grieving relatives that the men were killed. The distraught families of the three men have demanded independent autopsies on their remains in their native countries, claiming that the devout Muslims would not have violated the Islamic faith by committing suicide. Coffins containing the men's corpses were flown back to their homes at the weekend. Ali Abdullah Ahmed went to his native Yemen, while Maneh Shaman Turki Al-Habadi and Yasser Talal Al-Zahrani were returned to Saudi Arabia. Your response?
Well, there have been reports of numerous suicide attempts at Guantanamo. The military contends that these are acts of asymmetrical warfare, that the holy warriors are trying to disgrace the U.S. by, you know, taking their own lives and embarrassing the detention facility administrators. But the attorneys, who are the only people who meet and speak with the detainees, contend almost, you know, unanimously that there is a level of despair among the prisoners that is insurmountable, that, you know, after more than 4 years that most of them have been there without charges, without access to anybody in the outside world, without communications from their families. They have no idea, you know, how long they're going to be there, if they'll ever be released. They're told by the guards that, you know, they're going to be there until, you know, the war on terror is over. There's very little hope of escaping what are pretty harsh conditions, and I think, you know, it's not mutually exclusive that the prisoners either killed themselves out of despair or as a statement against their detention. But you know, clearly there's some of both.
Carol Williams, we had a debate on Friday on Democracy Now! With the president of the American Psychological Association and a dissident psychologist, as well as a brigadier general who was a psychiatrist. The AMA, the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, have come out against participation of psychiatrists and doctors at Guantanamo. The APA has yet to do that, the American Psychological Association. And head of the APA, Dr. Kuchar, said that the psychologists are there to minister to the mental health needs of the prisoners. What is your sense of that? Is that possible at this point?
Well, they do have a psych ward that they've added to the prison hospital annex in the last year, I believe. And there are, I believe, 8 resident, patients there. We've never been able to speak with the psychologists or get any sense from the professionals, what their state of mind is. There was one young detainee who had attempted to kill himself, hung himself, and he was in a coma for months. And I believe he has been repatriated to his home country. The psychological state in Guantanamo has to be dire. I mean, you can't lock up people in cages out in the desert-like barren wasteland of Guantanamo Bay for years without human contact and not have psychological consequences.
David Rose, your response to that, the role of these psychologists?
Well, the American Academy of Psychology, Psychiatry and the Law, quite some time ago suggested that its members should not take part. I do think that the state of the mental health of many detainees is very poor. I interviewed some of the British detainees when they first came back to Britain 1 year and 2 years ago, and I spoke to them again when I got back from my unfortunate trip last week, and I was very struck by how different they were, how much more articulate, how much stronger they sounded. They were really different kinds of people. I hadn't spoken to them for a good many months, and they were clearly getting themselves back to how they had been. But I do think there is another issue about this question of the suicides, if they were suicides, and I have to accept that is the likeliest explanation. I mean, the fact is, 3 people kill themselves on a single prison corridor where the doors of the cells are basically open gates so you can see right in, where the light is kept on all night. And according to Guantanamo's own kind of troop regulations, a soldier or a military police officer is supposed to walk past the door of each cell every 30 seconds. Now, Tariq Dergul, one of these British detainees that I interviewed, said that quite often they wouldn't do that. They just got bored and they would sit in their room at the end of the cell block playing cards and smoking cigarettes and not doing anything. And there would be occasions when he'd need something like, say, toilet paper, and he'd have to holler for an hour or more before anybody would come. You have to think that, to kill themselves in this way, the way that the military says that they did, by using bed sheets or clothing through the mesh of their cells, fashioning nooses, and then basically hanging to asphyxiate themselves. To make the noose is going to take you a minute. To die in that way, according to David Nicol, a consultant urologist I interviewed for my article, is going to take you at least 4 to 5 minutes, maybe longer. This is a case of criminal negligence, and it is rightly being invested by the Navy's Criminal Investigation Service. But this is the real reason why they didn't want media at Guantanamo last week. They're very happy to say we're transparent when they want to put on their highly chaperoned tours. And as Carol says, if you ask a blizzard of questions, sometimes somebody will let slip something and you actually find something out. But to have reporters there asking hard, tough questions when very, very difficult events are taking place, they just didn't want us.
David Rose, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Attempted to get into Guantanamo last week, was turned back. His book is called Guantanamo, The War on Human Rights. And Carol Williams, I'd like to ask you to stay with us for just one more minute on a wholly different issue. You're speaking to us from St. Kitts, where the International Whaling Commission is meeting. The commission has backed a resolution calling for the eventual return of commercial whaling for the first time in 20 years. This is Mike Townsley of Greenpeace.
We are breathing a huge sigh of relief this year, but next year we're going to face the same ridiculous situation. More countries brought in or bought in by Japan, And really, the conservation governments have got to do more.
Carol Williams, you're in St. Kitts covering the story. Can you talk about the significance of this whaling commission vote?
Well, it doesn't have any immediate influence on the whaling ban. It will take a 75% vote by the 70-member International Whaling Commission to overturn that ban, but it's a symbolic victory for Japan in that they have spent the last decade lobbying small Caribbean, African, and Pacific countries to their side with very substantial aid to their fisheries program or financial aid, and these little countries that have no whaling program, some of them are landlocked, are coming to Japan's side and voting to undermine the conservation role and responsibilities of the IWC.
Carol, thank you very much for being with us, Caribbean Bureau Chief of the Los Angeles Times in St. Kitts. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, New York Times op-ed columnist Paul Krugman. Stay with us.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's theirs? Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
Tracy Chapman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We spend the rest of the hour with Paul Krugman, the award-winning New York Times op-ed columnist. He spoke recently in New York about the new class war in America. In addition to writing for The Times, Paul Krugman is a world-renowned economist. He teaches at Princeton University.
I was actually trying to get a sense. I've been working with statistics, but I was trying to get a sense of what this America that we seem to have lost was like. And been going back and reading. Now, Time magazine had a kind of survey of just, you know, what is the country like in 1953 after the election of Dwight Eisenhower. And what they said, and the article began, even in the smallest towns and most isolated areas, the U.S. is wearing a very prosperous middle-class suit of clothes and an attitude of relaxation and confidence. People are not growing wealthy, but more of them than ever before are getting along. Now, that wasn't really fair, even in 1953. Certainly, if you were had the wrong skin color, if you were living in the wrong parts of the country, you wouldn't have agreed with that picture. But it was true of a lot of people. In fact, America really was a middle-class society during the 50s and the 60s. Not everyone, not large segments of the population, but it was a relatively middle-class society, a relatively even distribution, and there were not a lot of very wealthy people either. And it's not just that more people than ever before had a decent standard of living, but that the extremes, the plutocracy, seemed to have been pretty much tamed and to a large extent eliminated. You would never say that about the country now. You would say, gee, this isn't the, you know, we are now a country of great extremes. We're a country in which more and more people are having a hard time maintaining the essentials of a middle class existence, to say, you know, just to take the cutting edge of the degeneration, health insurance. More and more people losing that sort of basic security of life, job assurance. If you look at the long sweep, here's what you see about America. Once upon a time, there was the Gilded Age, period of enormous wealth, plutocracy. That lasted a lot longer than the history books would tell you. The Gilded Age is usually thought of as something that ended, and you know, once intellectuals began speaking about changing it, but it didn't, of course. It was really pretty much in place. All that wealth and privilege and widespread poverty and enormous gaps lasted right up into the 1930s. There was really, as far as we can tell, there was really no difference in the amount of inequality in 1929 from what it had been in the pre-World War I period. Then we became a middle-class society. We became a society that the one that, again, with allowing for Time magazine sort of missing a lot of people in that story, we became that relatively broadly based prosperity, which is the country I grew up in. And then we became, again, a dramatically unequal, class-ridden society. And if you look at the numbers, and also at just look around you, we are really back in all essential respects to Gilded Age levels of class differences and barriers. I do like my statistics, but I also like the impressionistic things. And one of the things I've always tended to look at is real estate. Specifically how ordinary people live, but also how the wealthy live. And if you were to go back, the shores of Long Island Sound are a good place to sort of catch an index of what's happening. In the Gilded Age and up through the 20s, into the 30s, the shores of Long Island Sound, both the North Shore of Long Island and the Connecticut coast, were where the super wealthy built their mansions. There were gigantic piles, huge things where people lived. By the time I was growing up, the mansions, most of them were still there physically, but they were no longer private mansions. People couldn't afford them. They were between a really serious diminution of the wealth of the wealthiest, taxes, income taxes, lower incomes, the estate taxes, and the fact that also Americans were too well paid to be hired as servants to maintain those things. Most of them had been given up. They'd been sold for very little to become schools and nursing homes, or they'd actually been given away and become museums or government buildings. Today, well, there was a story, actually. The current Vanity Fair, interesting thing how sometimes the best reporting is not coming sort of, you know, from the Washington Post, but from magazines. The story, which is actually mostly prurient interest, but it's pretty interesting anyway, about Greenwich, Greenwich, Connecticut, where there are still a lot of the old Gilded Age mansions there. And it turns out that what's been happening in Greenwich is that hedge fund managers have been buying up the Gilded Age mansions and knocking them down to build much bigger residences. The typical ones that they're describing now are about 30,000 plus square feet, which is about the size of the Taj Mahal. So that's the impressionistic thing. Terms of the numbers, just to say, and this can easily become a grind, but it's worth saying, the important thing to realize about what's happened to America, both the flattening of our income distribution that happened in the middle of the century and the widening out that's happened again, is it's not a story about the top, you know, quarter of the population pulling ahead or the top 15%. The great bulk of the action is really a few percent, in many cases, just a very, very small number of people. If you were to look at there's been a large rise since the 1970s in the share of income that's gone to the top 10% of the population. I've gone through that, and if you work it out, it turns out that most of that rise is actually the top 1% of the population, and about half of it is the top quarter of a percent of the population, which means at the moment, or actually 2003, which is the last date for which we have it, people with incomes of more than $750,000 a year. So we're really not talking about, you know, you'll hear stories that say, well, you know, people with good education and skills are pulling away from the rest of the population. Well, it's true that by and large, people who are earning $750K or more a year have college educations, but not everybody, right? It's like I like to say, the Fortune 500 CEOs and high school teachers have got on average about the same number of years of education. They're not exactly experiencing the same pay raises. So this is tremendous elitism. Now, why does all of this matter? It matters because, partly because it just means that most people are not sharing in economic growth. And the standard of living of the typical American family is, well, is it higher or lower than it was 30 years ago? You know, we can ask that question, but the fact that you even have to ask is telling you something. It's close enough. Consumption of material goods seems a little bit higher, but job security is clearly a lot less. People are working longer hours. The risk of losing health insurance is much greater. The difficulty of getting your kids into a decent school is much harder. So it's a mixed picture, but certainly not. If you'd asked in 1973, are people better off than they were in 1947? People would have had, there was no question. Enormous progress. If you ask that now about 30 years ago, it's not at all clear what the answer is. It's only the top few percent of the population that have had an enormous gain. So that's one thing. We've had economic growth, but it hasn't been broadly shared. But I actually think that that's almost the least of it. Much more important is what this polarization of incomes does to our society. Now there's part of it that I can't document too well, but I'm working on, which is I think it actually just poisons the feeling of our society. And there's a reasonable amount of evidence that having a highly unequal society undermines the trust that people have in each other, because they don't believe that, that we're all in the same boat, that it actually increases corruption. John Kenneth Galbraith died recently, I've been reading his book, The New Industrial State, which was a fantastic portrait of the way American capitalism was in the 60s, but he thought it would persist forever, and it didn't. And one of the things he says there at length is that the whole issue that corporate executives might engage in self-dealing, that they might enrich themselves at the expense of the corporation, it's just nothing to worry about. There's no problem on that. And that was probably true around 1967. You ask, why has that changed? And one of the answers is, well, in the days when executives were paid like government officials, the incentive to lie and cheat, you might get yourself a promotion, a bit larger salary, but if you were caught, that was the end of your career. Now, if you lie and cheat, you can walk off with a couple of $100 million after a couple of years. And if you are then booted from the company, you can probably find a way to not, unless you are really, really stupid, you won't get convicted by a jury. Ken Lay, okay, but Richard Scrooge walked away, and you're set. So the incentives, the inequality in itself, creates the possibility of corruption in a way that wasn't there before. And there's the political process. Let me tell you a historical story I've been working on quite a lot. Before the New Deal, there was a movement. There was an attempt. There was a progressive movement. People did try for reform. The great reformist of the time was Al Smith, the governor of New York, who was a poor kid who made his way up and retained, at least for a while, his feeling for the kind of people he grew up with, and ran a very serious campaign for reform, for what would have been a sort of proto-New Deal policy in 1928. And it was, at that point, one of the ugliest campaigns ever in American history. The trouble was that basically most people would have stood to benefit from the kinds of things Al Smith was advocating. So what was the Republican Party, which at that time, by the way, the Republican Party had fundraising offices in every state, plus one for the North Shore of Long Island, where there were 500 mansions, just to give you a sense of how things worked, who ran the party. They had to find something, so what they found was that he was he was an Irish Catholic, And so there was this horrifying smear of cultural fears campaign against Al Smith with burning crosses and everything that managed to swing a number of southern states, which being relatively poor actually would have stood to gain quite a lot from his policies, that turned a lot of those states against him. And so they were able to exploit, you know, cultural divisions. But although fundamentally it's not, there's no evidence that the people who were actually running this is Herbert Hoover's campaign. There's no evidence that Herbert Hoover was himself a violent anti-Catholic bigot or that the people running his campaigns were, but they had found an issue that they could use to sort of... Does this all sound kind of familiar? Right? And I think that's true. Now, what I can say for sure, and actually some of my colleagues at the Princeton and Politics Department work have done very interesting work on politics, and what they show is that the polarization of politics, you could measure. And I would say the nastiness, which is very, they can't exactly measure, but is very closely correlated, is very much, it rises and falls with income inequality. Periods, the Gilded Age, the 20s, were periods of grotesque abuse of cultural issues, anything to smear people who might suggest things like, you know, progressive taxation. And times when those kinds of views, when everyone had more or less accepted the existence of the New Deal institutions, were quite calm. So that same Time magazine article in 1953 is saying, Republicans and Democrats have a surprising sameness of outlook and political thinking, and that makes a big point about how Eisenhower had made it clear that he was not going to try to roll back the New Deal. Well, that's why that's a consequence of being a relatively equal society, and the ugliness and the viciousness of our political scene right now, I think, are in fact largely a consequence of the gross inequalities that have emerged. Why? How did we? What happened? There's a tendency to say, well, it's these impersonal market forces, or maybe it's globalization requires inequality, or just technology. There's always some truth to that kind of thing, but much less than you might imagine. I've already mentioned a little bit about education. We keep on hearing that technology creates this premium for education, for the creative classes, whatever it might be. Turns out that that's really... Well, put it this way, the median college-educated American has, unlike the median non-college-educated American, actually seen some gains in income over the past 25 years. But they're tiny. It was less than 1% a year on average, and in fact, over the past 5 years, most college-educated workers have actually seen their incomes fall once you adjust for inflation. It's not actually true that a college education is the key to being successful. It's being part of the tiny magic circle of the economic elite that gets you ahead. So it really isn't about education. It isn't about skills. A little bit of it is about, we like to talk about human capital being what matters. If you actually look at the last 5 years, human capital has been losing, but good old capital has actually been doing extremely well. Share of profits in national income is at its highest level since 1929. It's not at least that particular impersonal market force, and a lot of it looks like it's the political process does a lot to drive the distribution of income. Partly, of course, taxes. Taxes which tax the rich and provide benefits to everyone at large. But also other things, whether you have a political environment that basically assures workers of the right to organize, or one that basically is sympathetic with employers who try to break unions. Whether you have a general set of political pressure that says that fairness is a good thing, or that says that greed is good.
Paul Krugman, the New York Times op-ed columnist, author of the book The Great Unraveling, a collection of his columns, speaking last week at the New York Ethical Culture Society and the launch of Greg Palast's book called Armed Madhouse. And that does it for today's program. We'll post the whole speech at our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Mike DeFilippo, Aaron Mate are our engineers. Special thanks to Megan Whitney and Samantha Chambly. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.